Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalised approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover, and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam. I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And I'm Dr. Kate Steele, and today's episode is Eye of the Tiger Part 2, where we'll discuss anaesthesia for eye surgery with special guest Dr. Lahiru Amaratunga. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANSCA.
In part one of this series, our cases were pretty straightforward, but we want to throw a bit of a curveball your way with our next case, whose stem was actually a previous anaesthetic viva. But please note, we're not progressing the case in the same way as the viva.
So, Lahiru, you're at home and the junior night anaesthetic registrar rings you at 2 a.m. to let you know about a case which has just been booked. There is an 18-year-old man with a right open eye injury, which the ophthalmology team wants to explore within the next 6 hours. Your registrar tells you that he has just started an appendectomy and he hasn't done any eye cases before and would like to know what he should do.
The history from the ophthalmology registrar is that the patient had been out drinking, has allegedly been assaulted, fell to the ground, and has large facial swelling and an open eye injury and is alert. The patient is uncooperative, but the registrar doesn't think there are any other injuries and the patient is otherwise well. Your registrar would like to do the case after the appendectomy. What will you say?
Yes, this is, this is asking a direct question about what you'd say. And I mean, the first thing is, this is a complex case because, you know, you've got a patient who's essentially a trauma patient with a whole bunch of other issues that need to be sorted. So the first thing I'd say is, look, we need to make sure that the trauma screen is covered. And the next thing is that you would definitely come in for this case. I mean, especially because it's an exam, but also, you know, as soon as you get this presentation, it just looks like it could be complex. Now, I did check with my ophthalmologist sister about this, and they said, look, it's often that these penetrating eye injuries should happen first list in the morning. It's microsurgery. You need a very sharp surgeon for this case. Mm. And you don't want, like, they would generally not just come in at, you know, whatever time, 4 a.m., 5 a.m. for this case. Mm. That's just her opinion on this. But, you know, I've worked in a trauma hospital. And I've got to say, I've never had this case happening where, you know, at the wee hours of the morning. It's always been kind of later in the evening or first thing in the list in the morning. So that makes sense. So in answer to the question, I think the question is, the registrar would like to do the case after the appendectomy. I'd probably ask for a very thorough trauma assessment, full anesthetic assessment, and then just clarify with the surgeon what they need and what time they think this should be done reasonably. And that's probably where I'd get started with.
Mm. Now, do you have any concerns when it comes to managing a case like this?
Yeah, the two major concerns here is penetrating eye and an intoxicated patient. So those probably are the two things that you'll be trying to balance, if I was to be very specific. And really, you know, intraocular pressure increases can happen for many, many reasons. And least of those reasons, or just one of the many reasons, is going to be your anesthetic. Mm. And so I know that, you know, there's a lot of theoretical risk about a lot of the things that we'll do. And I think, like everything else in anesthetics, if you just do something well and don't mess up really badly, you're not going to have a significant increase in intraocular pressure. So, you know, in this patient, you know, it's going to be a rapid sequence induction, but you'll just have to give a decent dose of propofol, which will lower the intraocular pressure. You've got to give a decent dose of the right muscle relaxant, which can be either Sux or Rocuronium. It's not going to matter that much either way. There's no definitive study showing one is going to cause intraocular expulsion of contents versus another, and make sure you put the tube in well. If you need to bag mask the patient, that's fine. You know, the patient's ramped up. It's very unlikely to get aspiration in most circumstances. So if you need a bit more time, if you're in trouble with oxygenation, you don't need to rush through with, you don't think you need to rush through with anything that might suddenly increase the blood pressure, increase intraocular pressures as well. I think that's pretty much the big ticket items on intraocular pressure. And I know there's lots of other things that you can do. So, you know, during my induction, you know, am I that control? Am I that worried about blood pressure? You know, I guess I am. I would absolutely use a big dose propofol. I'd probably use alfentanil to make sure that I'm getting the best, you know, a fast acting agent. And I think having a big dose of relaxin, you know, 1.2 milligrams per kilogram of rocuronium or 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of sucks, making sure that that's working before I go in with gentle laryngoscopy, maybe use a video laryngoscope, so I'm using less traction, is going to help. And, you know, after that, you know, I'll have lignocaine in my propofol potentially. I'll have Esmol ready. Yeah, this is not the trickiest induction, I'd say. If the penetrating eye object was coming out at you, absolutely, this will be very complicated. But most times, if it's like a nail or a, you know, some other small device, I don't see this as a high risk induction on the realms of a, you know, wake fiber optic or a tamponade induction or something else like that.
So our patient presents to theatre and he is still obviously under the influence of alcohol, as he has slurred speech and slightly uncoordinated movements. He is agitated and aggressive towards the theatre staff with frequent shouting. We know that he is otherwise well and with no known allergies and that he is unfasted. So how are you going to manage this patient's induction?
Yeah, there's a bit of a horrendous dilemma. They're in theatre now, or they're about to get into theatre and this happens. I think the first thing is, you know, the usual things you'd want to talk about reasonably is safety of the patient themselves and the safety of the staff and having appropriate security code just to be able to manage that, because you're not trained, you're an anaesthetist, you're not trained to be managing aggressive patients. And the next thing is, yeah, the patient's safety is not just the fact that they're agitated and aggressive, but the fact that you may need to ask the surgeon, hey, what's the risk to this patient? Is this something that we can wait until they, sleep it off and delay this operation? Or is this something we have to go through with a difficult induction of an agitated patient? And so I would absolutely have that conversation, try to figure out where we need to go with this. And, you know, let's say this is the more difficult answer, that we absolutely need to go ahead, the agitation and all of this, you know, this aggression is just going to make things worse for the patient's eye. I think this is a difficult combination of chemical and physical restraint. Choose your induction agent. But this may be as hard as getting a drip in and, you know, giving small doses of, you know, droperidol or ketamine or midazolam. You know, choose your agent and then deal with the problems and complications. So, you know, if I said, you know, going to give midazolam, be very aware that may increase agitation as well, and have other agents ready, have agents like ketamine ready. Maybe there isn't a drip in, maybe you need to give intramuscular 5 milligrams per kilogram of ketamine, which again, this will then be a tricky thing where you need to have all your airway stuff ready, having your ability to oxygenate and ventilate and do that immediately as well. But yeah, as you can see, I'm just trying to talk through what is a reasonable plan that the surgeon needs for patient safety. And how do I manage the complications of this, of giving any of these any of these agents to unfasted, agitated patients?
It's hard, isn't it? Because you're absolutely right. I think in this instance, with a patient that's not cooperating, that's aggressive and agitated, and you know, ketamine is one of the best things we can give intramuscularly. And it's always a balance of risk, because in theory, ketamine does increase intraocular pressure. But is it to the degree that it's actually going to be unsafe for the patient? Like, is it more unsafe than having a patient that's flailing around is going to injure themselves? It's a tricky situation. It's really hard.
And I think, you know, when they say blinking is the same intraocular pressure rise as giving a dose of sucks, and that sucks with muscle contraction, I can't imagine that ketamine is even in, it's probably a drop in the ocean of all the other things.
Yeah.
So I would personally hesitate giving ketamine.
Yeah, I agree with you.
That's fair enough.
So, look, you do induce and it progresses really well without incident. Well done, everybody. Surgery commences. The surgeon's slow, but they manage to save the patient's eye and the final sutures are going in. So what is your analgesic plan for this patient? Assuming you'd consented for it during your pre-op assessment, would you consider a regional technique?
Yes, I would absolutely ask the surgeon about this. You know, giving volumes of anything into the orbital space could increase intraocular pressure. So I'd be very cautious about that. If the surgeon says, yeah, no problems, give 2 mils of, you know, you can give 2 mils of a subtenos, even the surgeon can do it under vision. I'd absolutely defer to the surgeon on this. And, you know, aside from that, you know, having topical anesthetic drops for a period of time, having opioids, having multi-permanent allergies. I think all of these are really good options, and I'd absolutely discuss this with the surgeon for the wake-up. And not having a wake-up that they're coughing and, you know, having problems. So I would absolutely be running Remy for this wake-up for this patient, and, you know, take your time, do it slowly. As you do a neuro wake-up, you know, maybe, what do I know? You know, have the propofol turned off, have the Remy still running at 0.05 mics per kilo per minute, maybe one nanogram per mil TCI, if that's what you're familiar with, and just let them open their eyes and respond to commands, then take the tube out. Nothing's perfect, but just have your method and work through it.
Yeah. Okay.
Excellent. Oh, well, it's like you're a mind reader. You just answered my next question.
So in that case, before we move on to our last case, we should have a discussion about peribulbar and retrobulbar blocks. Do you do these blocks in your own practice?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because, if you look at the data, peribulbar blocks are very safe. Subtenous blocks are very safe. And I know that there's a thing in kind of the private anesthetic world or ophthalmic anesthetic world that you want to give the best cosmesis because your surgeon's got to run a business and make sure the quality of the surgery and the look of it, the cosmetic effect is good, because that's part of them promoting the business. And so I know that when I was starting out in private, and even in my later training years, it was this thing that you got to be doing peribulbars in private. So I don't do peribulbars with any of my surgeons. I pretty much have a conversation that says, you know, if the patient knows that they might have a red eye and they don't mind, and we avoid putting a needle blindly into the space, even though it's very, 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 very safe, you know, if you just, you know, ask the oldest anesthetists you have in your department who do retrobulbar or peribulbar blocks, and find out if they've had any complications. And I've done that. And often they've had one to two complications over a 30-year working career. And my argument is, patient can be consented. That's the first thing. And if I was a patient, even, you know, I'm 70, 80 years old, I'm not caring about cosmesis if there's even a small chance of a bad incident. And if you talk to your surgeon and say, we'll be working for 30 years, we may have one or two bad days, what would you prefer? I would absolutely, as a surgeon, go, yeah, just go with the subtenons. And look, I know there's plenty of amazing anesthetists out there who are extremely good at these blocks. But I just know that it's a sharp needle, and I don't know what I don't know about what variable vessels are in it. So do I do peribulbars for that, those reasons specifically? No. For the fact that I've got to check axial length and anticoagulation, no. But if I need to do it, I do it. I just, you know, make sure I'm very careful about it. I do my appropriate technique, and then I go ahead with it. Now, interestingly, so if you've got a super fast list, logically, a peribulbar takes time for the anesthetic to diffuse intracranially. And that just means that in a fast anesthetic turnover or fast surgical turnover, I think people potentially are doing retrobulbar blocks, but calling them peribulbar blocks. And that's why they're able to keep up with the surgeon. You know, if you've got 30 minutes for your block to work, absolutely it's going to work. If you literally stick the needle in and then the surgeon's ready, which what happens with me, it's got to be a retrobulbar. You got to be honest with yourself, right? So those are my kind of opinions about it. I just think most patients would consent to a subtenons, but even if the cosmetic effect wasn't that bad. Or was bad, sorry.
So, Lahiru, can you walk us through the way you do a peribulbar block on an awake and cooperative patient, not necessarily our previous intoxicated patient?
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, monitoring assistance, drugs, equipment, all the usual setup. And again, this is something I would absolutely do for every preparation. Things like, you know, for the exam, you want to get to the money, right? You don't need to talk about all the details of your preparation setup if it's just a standard thing. If something adds to the normal, like you're getting security, absolutely talk about that. So usual monitoring assistance, drugs and equipment. And my aim with this is to deposit local anesthetic around the cone, around the muscle cone, and that way over time it will diffuse and give an adequate echinesia and sensory block. So I use my normal mixture, 2% lead can, 30 units per mil hyalase, and I'm expecting to use around 5 to 7 mils total of this local anesthetic. My equipment is literally a 5 mil syringe, a 25 millimeter, 25 gauge needle. Some people use a 27, either is fine. And then, I do the same oxybuprocaine drops in the eye, betadine prep inside and outside the eye, covering the site of injection. And my approach for the infralateral approach to a peribulbar block is to go pretty much in the outer two-thirds or between the limbus and the outer canthus, a point between there, And that's where my incision point is, just above the orbital rim. And really what I'm trying to do is follow the bottom of the orbit floor and just slightly angle up, but not angling it too much that it's going to be injecting into inside the cone near the globe, near the optic nerve and stuff. You know, a lot of the complications that happen, I think we're done when people use long 30 millimeter needles, also when they're doing retrobulbar blocks. So, you know, potentially this is an incredibly safe block, but it is a needle. So what do I do? I angle first flat, and you know, they talk about specific directions, like you know you go past the equator, then direction is changed to 0.10 degrees cephalad and then 20 degrees medial. These are hard to really perceive. There's a lot of
there's
prop toes eyes, like a prop toes eye means that you may be past the equator as soon as you get the needle into the incision point. So I'm much more of the philosophy of have a look at the eye and just try to imagine where your needle is and not try to stick too much to these specific measurements, because you really need to have a good perception of where your needle is. Now, the incision point we mentioned, some people go conjunctivally, so they're lowering their lid. And what I personally do is I just go in it, through the skin and in back. That's just the way I've always done it. And I'm not doing enough of them to really change that practice anyway. And I'm not sure there's any great benefit of that. And then once I'm just a bit past the equator, I'm often at 25 millimeters up to the skin. Sometimes I'm less, sometimes I'm pushing in a bit more. And then I aspirate and I inject. And usually what you see is you get a lot of swelling down in the bottom eyelid. You don't really want that. So I might go a little bit further, aspirate and inject again. And that way I can just try to be okay about where I am. I'm not going in aggressively. If I'm getting upper lid drooping, it's probably retrobulbar. But if it is and it happens, I just put less anesthetic and I accept that I've probably gone maybe retrobulbar again. The needle is in there blind. I'm not exactly sure where I am, but I'm trying to be as safe as possible. Talk about withdrawing. As you withdraw the needle, injecting 1 mil to get the orbicularis oculi on the way out. I often don't do that. I think that having the speculum there and it's often enough, and I'm not really needing to do that. And that's probably it. The technique is then to close the eye with some tape and put 30 millimeters pressure for 10 minutes with a Honan's balloon. That's then decreases the intraocular pressure by reducing aqueous humor production. And then block is assessed after 10 minutes. I mean, this is the standard technique, right? But 10 minutes, that's way too long in a fast private list. So again, the technique, this traditional technique, doesn't make sense for a fast list at all. And then you assess the block. You should get ptosis, you get akinesia. And, sometimes you need a top-up. So often, almost every time, if it's a true perivolar block, you're not going to get medial rectus, my experience. And so your top-up block is to do the medial canthal injection. And, this is kind of a ballsy injection, because it is close to a lot of structures like the medial rectus and the nasal plate and probably vessels as well. I know there's centers. There's maybe, I remember one of the fellows came from a different state and said that in their state, everyone just did medial canthal injections, and that was
as a routine.
Didn't do the other one, and essentially it is like a retrobulbar technique essentially, so they're getting really great conditions. But the technique that you're using, you can use the 25 gauge needle as normal, but you just go far less and you're going at the medial canthal area, so needle inserted medial to the caruncle, parallel to the medial wall of the orbit, and maybe point it slightly upwards or cephalad and inject up to about 5 mils. Again, there's that risk of medial rectus damage as well. And there's other vascular structures around there.
I've never seen one of those before.
Again, all of this is just like double injections and something a peribulbar when a retro, when maybe you're just doing a retrobulbar. If you can just do it subtenous, it just takes away so many problems.
So what is the difference between the peribulbar technique and the retrobulbar technique? They're obviously pretty similar. Just, is it a different needle angle?
So often they talk about a 30 millimeter needle, so a longer needle inserted again, similarly intratemporally, but first you get it past the equator and then you direct more aggressively. So you're really changing the angle sharply. And I was never taught a specific, I worked with two anaesthetists who used to do these standard, and they didn't tell me any specific angle. The angulation of the needle was just more aggressive and pointing towards the back. The perception of the back of where the globe is. That's kind of where they were heading, but obviously not far enough that they would get the optic nerve or anything like that. Again, fantastic block, works really well. High risk of all the things like globe rupture, vascular rupture, optic nerve damage as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you need less anesthesia. Definitely, you know, 3 mils will be plenty for these cases.
Okay.
Mm. And Lahiro, what would you typically see if a patient experienced a retrobulbar hemorrhage after a peribulbar or a retrobulbar block had been performed?
Yeah, so this is really, really tricky. You may not see anything. So you may have a small bleed, and that would be something that you could easily miss. Like, it's not like there's visible blood coming out of the eye. You know, where is it coming out of? This is not something that you will have seen before and be very difficult to diagnose. Now, if you get a large one, you'll get suddenly in a proptosed eye, a very tight eye, and potentially it is proptosed, so you can't pull that lower lid away, whereas previously you could. So you imagine you're trying to close the eye, it's bulging out. Maybe if you've caught an artery, maybe it's pulsatile. Again, there's a lot of variability with this, and I feel like, you know, if this happened, you'd want, you know, the surgeon's already operating, you'd want to get some surgical input and say, hey, what's going on here? And they would, you know, with their expertise and their instruments, they may be able to diagnose this clinically, maybe with an indirect ophthalmoscope, and also checking pressures. But again, in a fast-paced list, you've got one surgeon. In a public list, you may have a registrar who can come and check things for you. But this is a bad situation, and very variable in how it presents, and you may not have the skills to detect it either.
How is it managed?
Yeah, so you need to do a lateral canthotomy. So literally, you're trying to cut the tendon that holds the lower lid to the lateral orbit. And this allows the eye to proptose without restriction, which increases the space behind the eye, which means that it releases the pressure on the eyeball. Like, if you think, like, all ischemic injury is increased pressure, decrease blood delivery, oxygen delivery, and that's where the problem is. It really has to be done within, you know, in less than 6 hours. So you hope perfusion returns, you check the retina is perfused, and you can, you know, clinically check that with the ophthalmoscope, and you check the pressures. You may be giving Dymox if the pressures are high. And then you can repair that in a non-urgent fashion. You can repair the canthotomy lesion in a non-urgent fashion. You really need to cover the eye, give the ointments as normal, and then watch for ulceration.
Okay.
Let's hope I never have to see one of those. Okay, so on to our last case scenario. Lahiri, you're covering the emergency board when the ophthalmology registrar calls and asks you to anaesthetise a 56-year-old man who has experienced a retinal detachment in the setting of diabetes mellitus. He is obese with a weight of 100 kilograms and a BMI of 35 and also has hypertension, hypercholesterolemia and smokes 10 cigarettes daily. He denies having any respiratory disease but has a dry chronic cough. He is fasted and ready for surgery. What is your approach to anesthesia for retinal detachment surgery?
Yeah, good. So again, I've actually not done the anesthetic for this before. So I talked to my ophthalmologist sister and said, you know, what's the deal with this? And like a lot of things, it's great that it's a lot of common sense. So the first thing is, what does the surgeon need? You know, sometimes they can do it with a GA. Sometimes they can do it with a block. They just need really good echinesia for this operation. So let's say you can do it with a block, then really, I've got the issues of the BMI. 100 kilos isn't too much. Most people can still lie flat with that. It's not the biggest deal. The smoking and chronic cough may be a problem, but the fact that giving fentanyl and maybe getting the patient to cough up whatever's been beforehand, I've never had to cancel a patient with a chronic cough because I'm giving them a powerful antitussive, and you know, the surgeons can deal with it a little bit, but it's never been a problem. So that's a block. You deal with the problem of BMI and the chronic cough as best as you can. Let's say the surgeon or other issues mean that you have to go ahead with a GA, then, you know, this is essentially, you know, again, we're doing a general anesthetic standard as is required by the patient. And I'm concerned about a lot of things here, the BMI and whether I can ventilate with an LMA. Generally speaking, you know, 56-year-old person, 100 kilos, I could probably do an LMA, but if they're unfasted, I want to do a rapid sequence with a tube. And, you know, if they're smoking, I've checked for, you know, do my appropriate optimization steps, give Ventolin, atropine, listen to the lungs, make sure I'm not going to cause a bronchospasm. So it's really a lot of things that I'm doing here, which are not really related to the retinal detachment itself. I'm just trying to do a standard induction in a patient who's got a few comorbidities that need to be optimized. And then, yeah, they essentially try to fix this can be fixed with a scleral buckle for young patients, and that can cause bradycardias intraoperatively, or they might need to, you know, do a vitrectomy. And so, you know, most people don't use nitrous for their cases, but that would be something we have to do. And then, like a lot of these intricate eye operations, avoid patient coughing, having any rise in intraocular pressure afterwards. So you may want to, if you've got an LMA, great, that'll be a standard smooth extubation. But if they've got a tube in, maybe, you know, you want to consider running Remi or giving fentanyl before you extubate.
Yeah, we do a fair bit of these after hours where I work, and they tend to be they tend to be vitrectomies, and we tend to do them under GA and plus minus tube. It just depends how well faster they are and when it's happened and that sort of thing. So that's all on the money.
Do you end up running Remi for these for the wake up, or
look, some people do and some people don't. It kind of depends on the time of depends on the individual, as you say. You know, it depends on the individual practitioner and the age of the patient. Obviously, the older patients sometimes we might avoid the Remi, but in younger patients we may. And I suppose the other option at the end of the case is a tube exchange. You know, exchanging for an LMA and then getting that to recovery, a nice sort of slow wake up and less coughing. So that's the other thing that would come to mind. Yeah, but that all sounds very sensible.
Excellent.
Look, Lahiru, we'd really like to thank you for joining us today. We always love when you join us, and we always have such a great time. Now, before we say goodbye, we have one final question for you. What have you learned in anesthesia this week?
In preparing for this topic, it was really interesting talking to my sisters. I occasionally private list with her. She lives in Perth, and I'll fly over to visit family and do that. But I never really talk about ophthalmology, so I got to say, it's really interesting to get a take on, you know, the lateral canthotomies and what you'd see. Because, you know, before doing this, like, you hear about retrobulbar hemorrhages and you just think it's going to be something that's quite obvious, but it just isn't. So I think that was quite an interesting thing that I was covering. And probably the other thing, actually, I've got this doctor from Italy who's working on some content with me, and he's actually talking, like, he actually was interested in, you know, what the rates of suicide in anesthesia were, and we were just having a chat about that, and he's actually written a really good blog post and about, you know, the fact that, yeah, so it's not a well-studied area, and potentially anesthesia do have a higher suicide risk. So probably a really good reminder that, you know, please take care of yourselves, because talk about anesthesia and suicide, it's like, you know, the best profession ever. We have great work-life balance. It's all good. So, you know, most of these are super happy until they're not happy. And then they've got access to things and, you know, maybe not the support they have. They're working in full-time private and maybe a bit more isolated depending on where they're working. So, you know, I think a really good reminder to, especially over holiday periods and things, to just to really look after yourself and ask your mates if they're okay. And
anesthetist people too, right? So prone to all the mental health difficulties and, you know, potential substance abuse and other issues that the general population are as well. So,
We're very much pack animals, human beings. So we work better when we're around other people. So reach out to family, friends, you know, make contact. It's worthwhile.
Yeah, good reminder. Yeah. So look, Lahiru, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and we want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me. Real pleasure, and anytime.
It's been a really enjoyable and informative discussion on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Don't forget to claim CPD if you are a provisional fellow or a consultant. If you're not sure how to do this, the instructions are in our episode notes.
And if you have any suggestions, questions, or just want to connect with us, send us an email at deepbreathspod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.